Support for this episode comes from Signature Bank.
Hi, this is Gary Head, Chairman and CEO of Signature Bank of Arkansas. Our bank was founded in Northwest Arkansas in May of 2005. And in 19 years, we have grown to over $1.1 billion in assets and 210 teammates to serve you. We have locations in Bentonville, Springdale, Rogers, Fayetteville, Harrison, Jonesboro, and Brinkley. We have a 100% Latino Hispanic bank in downtown Rogers we call Banco C. We're opening our second Banco C early this summer in downtown Springdale on Emma Street. We have a talented group of bankers that love the communities that we serve. All of our bankers have the authority to do business and are eager to do so. As chairman, I welcome your call at 479-684-3700 or visit us online at signature.bank and tell them that you heard about us first at I Am Northwest Arkansas. Signature Bank of Arkansas is a member of the FDIC and an equal housing lender.
Hey, it's Randy Wilburn from I Am Northwest Arkansas. We all know that access to safe and secure housing is crucial for thriving communities. That's why the Northwest Arkansas Council created Groundwork, a program dedicated to addressing the region's workforce housing needs. Whether you're a developer, policymaker, or just someone who cares about housing affordability, become an active participant in shaping Northwest Arkansas's future. Learn more and get involved in the pursuit of innovative housing solutions across NWA at groundworknwa.org. That's groundworknwa.org. Groundwork, building the foundation for a better Northwest Arkansas.
It's time for another episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas, the podcast covering the intersection of business, culture, entrepreneurship, and life in general here in the Ozarks. Whether you are considering a move to this area or trying to learn more about the place you call home, we've got something special for you. Here's our host, Randy Wilburn.
Hey, folks, and welcome back to another episode of the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. I'm your host, Randy Wilburn. And yes, we are in a new environment here. I'm not at the KUF radio station in the Furman Garner Performance Center. I'm actually sitting here at Go Rogue X Studio in Bentonville, Arkansas, and excited to support one of my dear friends, Brian Fitton, and his team, Lane, and the rest of the wonderful folks here. We're recording episodes here so we can bring you video as well as audio. And so I'm really excited to do that. I have an amazing guest to share with you today. And my guest is Bruce Katz. He's an expert on urban and metropolitan policy and a champion of innovative urban development. He's the founding director of the NOAC Metro Finance Lab at Drexel University, where he focuses on advancing urban growth through innovative financial solutions. He's a former vice president of the Brookings Institution, and Bruce has advised leaders worldwide on urban policy and economic development. And he's also the co-author of the book, The New Localism, which explores how cities can thrive in the age of populism. And this is the book here. It is an amazing reference, and I just jumped into it, and I just admitted to him, I hadn't had a chance to read the whole thing yet. But there's so much here. And of course, as a podcaster, the podcaster in me was like, I know he's got some podcast episodes out there. And I probably listened to like 10 or 12 of those just to kind of hear your thinking. But Bruce, I just want to welcome you to the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast and to Northwest Arkansas.
Well, Randy, thanks for having me. Great to be here.
Yeah, absolutely. So we at I Am Northwest Arkansas work with Groundwork, which is a part of the Northwest Arkansas Council. And one of the biggest issues that we deal with is affordable housing. It is kind of like the elephant in the room, if you will, right? And it's only been exacerbated by the pandemic and so many other factors that are honestly out of our control. But I would love for you, just as a bit of introduction to this audience, can you just kind of share a little bit about your background specifically and how you became interested in this whole idea or concept of new localism.
So I was fortunate enough when I was in high school, I was born in Brooklyn, New York, went to public high school. They had a program where you could take your last 6 months and actually go work. So I went to work for the New York City Council, and I became obsessed with all things city, whether it's housing, whether it's transportation, whether it's economics, corridors, enterprise, I mean, you name it.
Sure.
I became obsessed. So I ultimately went to college, went to law school. But what I always wanted to do was work on and around city issues.
Yeah.
So eventually I was able to work for the Senate Housing Subcommittee, the federal level, was chief of staff at HUD, went to Brookings to start a think tank on cities. New localism is essentially the way to describe how U.S. cities function, which is really as these public, private, civic collaboratives that come together to collaborate to compete or not. And so if you're dealing with an issue like housing or transportation or physical geography, at the end of the day, it's this amalgam of leaders, institutions, stakeholders that come together.
Yeah. And I heard you mention just the impact that your time with HUD Secretary Cisneros, how that impacted your view of this whole idea of new localism, because he was also an amazing mayor.
Incredible mayor.
I mean, he was a mayor of San Antonio before he became the secretary of HUD.
So Henry had an enormous impact on my thinking and on my career. I mean, he is a true mentor. And I think what he introduced me to was the concept of metropolitan areas, because San Antonio, like a lot of cities in Texas, is supersized, like everything in Texas, it's supersized. So it's a city of a million plus and a very large landmass. So you incorporate urban core, older suburbs, middle suburbs, exurbs, rural areas. And it really gets to a question is, how does a metropolis function? They're the units of our geography, but very fragmented in terms of how they're governed, municipalities, counties, et cetera. So he really, as HUD secretary, tried to promote this, what was then essentially a new concept of metropolitan collaboration. And a lot of my career has flowed from that.
Yeah. And it seems like, I mean, you took an iterative process until you came to this whole concept or idea of new localism. And you partnered up with Jeremy Nowak, the late colleague of yours, who co-wrote this book.
That's right.
And he was if I remember correctly, he is a kind of a CDFI champion. Is that correct?
So Jeremy founded the Reinvestment Fund, which is now one of the largest community development financial institutions, an idea that was very much promoted by President Clinton.
Yeah.
I mean, the CDFI industry, to some extent, came to fruition under President Clinton, and Jeremy was at the forefront of that. He was continuously voted the most disruptive person in Philadelphia, which just gives you a sense of what Jeremy
Good
was
trouble,
like.
As they say, right?
A lot of trouble. But what Jeremy and I really enjoyed doing was what we would consider to be rolling in the mud. If you want to write about cities, if you want to advise people around cities, you better go to places and from the ground up really learn what challenges are, what opportunities are. Do they collaborate, or is it just a fragmented mess, to tell you the truth? So Jeremy and I had an enormous amount of fun writing this book.
Yeah.
Enormous amount of fun. And it's hard to remember at times, like, okay, which is a sentence I wrote or a paragraph I wrote and which one he wrote. It was just truly collaborative.
Yeah. And it seems like and this book was born out of a time when the nation was going through a lot of change.
That's right.
Right after the 2016 election.
It was both the U.S. and also Europe, because the Brits had voted Brexit. On Brexit.
Yeah.
And what we saw and we still see was the rise of right-wing parties in Germany and Sweden and elsewhere. And so we were trying to sort through at what do you do at the local level or at the metropolitan level when your national politics become so volatile?
Yeah.
And generally, you know, my thinking really across whoever is in power in Washington or in states is that the local level is where you see this sort of horizontal nature of leadership that cuts across sectors and fundamentally want to make their place better. So politics doesn't play out at the same way it plays out at the national level, at the local.
At the local level, yeah. And as you kind of likened it, and I always like to look at themes, but you likened it to when we think about the federal government, that's on a vertical axis.
Absolutely.
And the states are on a horizontal axis, yeah, where the opportunities are broad. And so there's a lot of, you don't have to look up for something. You mean the solutions to the problems that exist in your local community are right there next door.
No, and I think, you know, when the federal government operates, it has a department for everything, right? There's Environmental Protection, Department of Energy, Department of Housing, Department of Transportation, and they are verticals. They talk about collaborating across the agencies. Very difficult to do.
Yeah.
When you're local, you just see the relationship between land use, transportation, housing, environment, enterprise, industry, workforce. It's fairly obvious you need to connect the dots.
Right.
And
right.
So the successful places use national investment or private investment, philanthropic investment, to really, you know, become the best version of themselves.
Yeah. And so, I mean, in this way, you have found that cities are becoming the vanguard of problem solving in today's world. What more than anything else has kind of led you? I know you've seen examples around the world. But what has kind of crystallized that idea in your mind as far as that's concerned?
Well, where this started was that the national government was basically on a frolic and a detour. I mean, occasionally it would do stuff. I mean, my view of the national government is it's, in the U.S., it's mostly a healthcare company with an army.
Yeah.
I mean, if you actually follow the money,
sure,
that's what they do. Okay. I mean, you know, healthcare is like 18% of our GDP here. A lot of it's backstopped by federal investment, Medicare, Medicaid, all the rest.
Sure.
And the military is substantial. Department of Defense probably will reach about $1 trillion a year, given the belligerent state of the world today. So that's really what our national government does. And when it comes to housing and transportation and other issues, sometimes, like under President Biden, you see substantial new investments. A lot of time what you see drift and discord and partisan rancor. So at the end of the day, if you're at the city level or you're the metropolitan level and you've got challenges, you've got to figure out really how to resolve them. If you wait for Washington, you could be waiting for a very long time. And even when funding is flowing, they are investors, but they're not telling Northwest Arkansas or anyone else for that matter, here's how to use the money most efficiently and effectively. It's up to the local city, county, municipality, and your business and philanthropic and university partners to sort all this out. So new localism, we wrote this at a time when we felt that the national government was adrift. But even when the national government is sort of operating on all cylinders, they've still delegated design.
Sure.
Down.
Yeah.
And so you got to have your act together.
Yeah. And you pointed out some very important things that I do want to get into. But before we do that, I'd love for you to maybe share some of the shining examples that you have seen where this new localism has kind of taken on a new meaning for people. I know you mentioned Copenhagen.
Yeah.
Of course, you talked about Pittsburgh, as I said earlier, but I'd love for you maybe just to talk a little bit more in depth about why some of those cities have experienced this whole idea or concept of new localism and what they are doing that works.
So I think a common theme throughout the book, and we focus on Pittsburgh, Indianapolis, and Copenhagen, are places that really deindustrialized early.
Yep.
I mean, Pittsburgh's where the steel industry collapsed at the end of the 1970s for a whole bunch of reasons. And what essentially happened was a group of political leaders, mayor, governor, county leader, business, the Allegheny Conference, and then most importantly, Carnegie Mellon, University of Pittsburgh, and a group of philanthropies, particularly the Heinz Endowments. Yeah. They basically said, we are flat on our back. We have lost, I mean, tens of thousands of jobs almost overnight. What's our future? We can't go back, right? We're not going to repeat that. We need to go forward. They began to invest at scale in what has essentially become the robotics industry in the United States.
Yeah.
So they did not know at the time that that's what they were doing. They just basically said, we are going to have to travel the high road and create new sectors of the economy, particularly related to advanced technologies. And we got Carnegie Mellon and we've got Pitt.
Yeah.
I mean, we've got the University of, UPMC, the big healthcare system.
Right.
So they're like a 40-year, overnight success story. right? I mean, because if you're going to move markets, it ain't going to happen in a 2-year cycle.
Right.
You've got to look in the long term. But they were consistent and relentless and took risk. And I think, cities, the best cities think like systems and act like entrepreneurs.
Right.
You think across lots of issues, but then you take risk. Right. And sometimes you fail and you dust yourself off and you get up again. Copenhagen actually is quite similar to Pittsburgh because their industries collapsed. I mean, if you went to Copenhagen in the late 1980s, so a decade after the Pittsburgh steel industry collapsed, I mean, there were billboards, last one out, shut the lights off, right? So the port collapsed, industry collapsed, and suddenly, the government had just incredible amount of property between the downtown and the airport along the harbor front. And they were really able to put in place a new model around the disposition of public assets, what the government owns, in the service of a new city, which is now one of the wealthiest cities in the world.
Sure.
Livable, bikeable, walkable, all the rest of it. But they recreated their physical space and they used the redevelopment along the harbor front to finance a transit system, which is now one of the best in the world.
Yeah.
So phenomenal innovation.
Yeah. And I think sometimes, we learn by seeing others do.
Right.
Right. And I think that's what's important. And I know here in Northwest Arkansas, we are struggling with our own challenges. We have, as I like to say, we have the big three in our backyard, which is Walmart, of course, one of the largest employers in the world. We have J.B. Hunt, biggest logistical company.
Yep.
And then, of course, we have one of the largest meat producers in the world. We have it all right here in our own backyard. And yet and still, I think people think that can sometimes be enough. And in reality, there needs to be more in order to achieve the kind of objectives that we want to achieve.
Well, you're also in a world that's shifting pretty radically because of geopolitical tensions, because of climate. So what's happening right now is the U.S., again, 40 years after the collapse of the steel industry in Pittsburgh, we are reshoring production in the United States. We're reshoring manufacturing. You see that with semiconductors. You see that with defense production. You see that in the auto sector as we shift to electric vehicles and batteries. So we almost lost our muscle memory around manufacturing because we decided offshore, outsource, globalize excessively. But we're bringing it back now for a bunch of different reasons. And I think that's the rebirth of the U.S. And it will create much more balanced growth. I mean, to some extent, the last several decades was the period of the superstar cities. And a lot of venture capital tended to concentrate in San Francisco and Seattle and L.A. and Boston and New York, now in Austin. But this is beginning to balance growth out. I mean, Columbus, Ohio, with Intel and semiconductors, Syracuse with Micron, the whole submarine industrial base along the East Coast is building the next generation of nuclear-powered submarines. So these are technologically sophisticated, pieces of equipment. And I think the U.S. is able to adapt faster than other countries because everyone's in charge, no one's in charge.
Right.
That's our culture.
Yeah.
So you have great assets here. You've got the flagship university for the state of Arkansas. The question is, what kind of future do you want to imagine?
Right.
And you're also just located in such an interesting place on the border of Missouri and Oklahoma and Kansas. So you're like a four state.
Yeah.
Kind of phenomenal.
We are in the center of it all. That's why they call it the heartland.
Absolutely.
That's why they call it the heartland. There are a couple of concepts that you've shared, and I want to continue down this road that we're talking about with regard to Northwest Arkansas. You said earlier the importance of certain people in the room working together.
Yes.
And what I hear more is collaborating, right?
Totally.
So the private sector, you have the educational sector, and the civic public sector.
Right.
Of cities. And, I would be curious to know, what have you seen that has really made a difference when it comes to those sectors, like all playing nice in the sandbox, if you will?
Well, it's quite interesting because a lot of this is really just human behavior.
It is.
So you can talk about collaboration, which sounds like a nice and easy word. It's really complicated when people have to submerge their egos. And I generally can tell within, you know, several hours of being in a place, okay, is this a collaborative ecosystem? Or does everyone just basically hate each other for some particular reason right. and have grudge matches that go back several decades?
Yeah.
And the way you know that it's a functioning place is you'll be in a meeting with an individual. They might be from a philanthropy. They might be from a university or a business leadership group or local government, county government. And you'll start talking about a particular issue, housing or industry. And they'll immediately say, oh, you need to talk to so-and-so. They really know something about right. this. And then said, let's get them on the phone right now. Then you're in a collaborative ecosystem.
Right.
In other places, when you start having this conversation, they'll say, well, so-and-so's working on that, but it's not going very well.
Yeah.
You know?
they throw you under the bus right away.
It's just really, you know, I was watching, you know, the Beatles Get Back documentary, which uh-huh. is how... And to some extent, that's like a masterclass in collaboration. They obviously are having lots of problems with each other, but somehow they come together to create this masterpiece. It's a little bit like how metropolitan areas operate.
Yeah.
It's a 2+2=5 phenomenon when you get it right. That's what Henry Cisneros taught me.
Yeah.
When you really are able to work across sectors and disciplines, magic happens. Many places are 2+2=3. Okay. I mean, it's almost like you just don't leverage your assets and you spend most of your time fighting with each other.
Yeah. I have found, and I've been here for 10 years, and I have found that people here not just are very accommodating, but are very giving of their time
yep.
and of their talent. No one's ever told me no, but of course, everybody likes to talk about themselves. So whenever I invite people to come on the podcast, you know, everybody Absolutely. Likes to talk about their favorite subject, which is themselves. So, I mean, it's just the way it is. But I have, and I tell people this all the time because I'm from the East Coast like you are. And so I have an appreciation for what it's like. I've lived on both coasts. I understand. But I said, there's something different and special about Northwest Arkansas. And I do hope you see that. I'm going to have to circle back with you in a couple of months to get your real take on this area after you've had a chance to digest it.
Yep.
But I have said, and I've lived all over the world, that these people in Northwest Arkansas are some of the most giving people that I've ever run across, that people legitimately want to see other people benefit and succeed, whether it's overcoming food insecurity. And of course, dealing with the housing issue. It's a major issue that I see a lot of people taking up, even though that's not in their job description. It's not in my job description, but I'm talking about it because I feel very strongly that we will not be a strong community if we can't provide housing to everyone.
Well, then you've got a lot to build on if you have that culture. I remember in another book, The Metropolitan Revolution, I talked about Denver. And Denver is a place that is known for metropolitan collaboration. It's a phenomenon. I mean, Denver is just an incredible, growing, prosperous metropolis.
Yeah.
I remember talking to the mayor, Federico Pena, who became Secretary of Transportation, sure. I said, what was the secret to the collaborative ethos? He says, well, I decided to get up, drive to an adjoining municipality and bring the donuts, you know? I mean, if you're going to try to collaborate, everyone can sit in their own city halls or their leadership groups or their, and not try to basically bridge what is a true divide.
Yeah.
Which is just more complicated now for a whole bunch of reasons, but real barriers between these municipal borders and county borders and all the rest, let alone sectors.
Yeah.
So the folks who can basically break that down are the ones who, you know, you're not coming in with a solution. You're coming in with a common challenge that you're trying to sort out.
Right.
And then really opening up and listening.
So again, we've been separated. The creation of this book and actually, I mean, obviously, this book is the embodiment of what you've been working on for a number of years.
Since the cradle,
right. So a number of years, you put a lot of time and effort, both you and Jeremy, but then we had a pandemic.
Yeah.
Did the pandemic change anything with regard to this whole concept or idea of new localism? Did it unearth something that maybe you didn't see when you wrote the book that has now guided you maybe in a little bit, has caused you to course correct at all?
In some ways, it did separate out a bunch of places. So take St. Louis, for example. Mm-hmm. which is a very racially stratified, segregated place.
Totally.
Very difficult place.
Well, we saw that with Ferguson.
Absolutely.
So, yeah.
What happened during the pandemic was the hospitals in particular came together with the business leadership, electeds, philanthropy, and said, okay, this virus obviously is not respecting borders.
Right.
Okay. We need to get our act together. So they began to collaborate in some really interesting ways. At the end of it, they merged five different business organizations into one, Greater STL. I worked with them on a jobs plan, basically is now with all this federal investment fund has led to some major investments coming into St. Louis so that they can build off of like a tremendous base. And they spent a lot of time on what would be considered inclusive growth. So how do we work in a way that cuts across the racial lines that have divided us for so long? So Boeing, for example, has just made a major investment with federal money, state money, local money in an advanced manufacturing innovation center in North St. Louis,
okay,
which is one of the most disinvested communities in the entire country.
Yeah.
I think that came out of the pandemic. It compelled a level of collaboration in that place, in that metropolis, that frankly had not occurred before. And now they're well set to succeed and prosper, to win the decade, essentially.
Yeah.
So in some respects, the pandemic, but not uniformly, had that impact. The pandemic also, you know, from a structural perspective, has completely upheaved the geography of work. And because of remote work and hybrid work, and so a lot of central business districts, which were really central office districts, are finding whole portions of their workforce working from home,
right,
2 or 3 days a week. This has had enormous effect in San Francisco, in Chicago, in Philadelphia, in some of the major cities that were relying, a lot of small businesses were relying on those office workers, the transit system, the entire tax system.
Right.
So there's a lot of adjustment to what the pandemic didn't create remote work or hybrid work. It accelerated it.
Yeah, to a point where that's an item that you'll never put back in the bottle.
Never.
I mean, and a lot of businesses, a lot of verticals want to, but I don't think it's ever going to happen.
Look, and a lot of people were taking punishing commutes in the morning. Yeah. And so they have, in many respects, it has the potential to make us more productive. Because we're not spending our time in, you know, hour-long commutes. So all this is getting sorted now.
Yep.
You know, things are never like, some things like COVID, there was immediate lockdown. But the impact of the pandemic on the commercial real estate industry and the value of office properties, it's being felt today. I mean, literally today.
Absolutely.
So we're going to be coming out of this. This is a decade-long transition at a minimum.
Yeah.
You know, and again, some places have pivoted pretty quickly because they've taken advantage of other market dynamics like reshoring to compensate for the loss of, you know, concentrated office districts.
Yeah. What advice would you have for local governments, businesses, and citizens to understand and embrace this whole idea or concept of playing the long game when it comes to new localism, right? I mean, you talked about Pittsburgh. You said, it was a quick 40 years. and I know people here, because we keep talking about in Northwest Arkansas, we are approximately about 580,000 people.
Yeah.
We're one of the fastest growing MSAs in the country. We're supposed to be 1 million people by 2045.
Right.
A lot's going to change in the next 20 years. I mean, a lot.
Right.
But how do we get into that mindset or framework of understanding that it is a long game? I'm doing things right now that my kids are going to benefit from and potentially their kids if they stay in this area. But how do we play that long-term game and not be struck by any shiny new objects that might just show up but then eventually just disappear?
Yeah, I think at the heart of it, it's coming to a realization in the United States, other countries operate differently, that no one has your back. All right. I mean, it's not like
Say that again.
Yeah. No one has your back. It's not like the national government is waking up in the morning and saying, hey, we need to really worry about Northwest Arkansas. I don't think so.
Yeah.
Right. The state, for the most part, in most states, have really delegated both the vision and the implementation and execution of long-term planning down.
Sure.
So the cavalry's not coming.
Yeah.
Right. And we've got a lot of mega challenges that are facing our people and our communities. And I think for individuals, the long game is really to think about, do I want to create a place that has such quality and it's such collaboration that my kids want to stay here, and they can stay here because there are good jobs, quality jobs, and a sense of civic pride.
Yeah.
And a sense of civic possibility. So this is in some respects very selfish, because in a way, I mean, you're trying to defy what has happened in the U.S. over many decades. As your kids grow up, and you know, many are educated by public university systems,
right,
and then they headed to Silicon Valley.
Yeah.
You know, we exported, you know, all this talent to other parts of the country. I think the potential now is to rebalance growth and create these pockets of prosperity all over the country, and then to make sure prosperity is shared by a broader set of our population, because we're reindustrializing.
Yeah.
And as we reindustrialize, that brings back quality jobs, pay well, decent benefits. We can regrow the middle class. So I think there are dozens of places that can do this, hundreds of places that can do it. But if you don't have that plan, it's not like someone else is doing it.
Yeah. Yeah. And they're not going to, it's not going to come down. I think you mentioned it. Somebody's not going to bring tablets down off the mountaintop and hand them to you. So
not at all.
Yeah.
You're in charge of your own destiny.
Yeah. Yeah.
On just about everything.
Yeah.
So that's a harsh realization, but I think it's, you know, once you sort of imbibe, you know, really absorb that, you then are on the path to progress.
Yeah. Man, there's so much to unpack here. Would you be able to maybe give us some one or two innovative ways that cities are using technology and data to improve governance and address challenges that they're dealing with on the local level?
Yeah, I think there is like a smart cities movement that has been underway for some period of time. And you know, part of the issue is there's too much data in some respects, and you got to figure out what really matters to you. So some of this is about government performance of their own duties and responsibilities. And I think there's been an enormous progress made on that front, both within the U.S. and beyond the U.S. The other way in which I think data is being used is to try to figure out, it goes back to one of your prior questions, what is your authentic position? Mm-hmm. You know, what really separates you out from other parts of the country? Because you've got these major industry players, and you've got a flagship university. But in the end of the day, the places that succeed will begin to bend what that university researches and, you know, the kind of talent they're creating to what might be a special position for you. So I think that's what Pittsburgh did in a way. Off of an old steel industry and an industry legacy, they helped create the robotics industry. They became sort of a leader in, you know, computing, you know, with funding from all over the country and corporate funding.
Yeah.
It wasn't they were just getting academic research funding. They were getting corporate funding to try to problem solve. So for cities in terms of their governmental duties, but also metros in terms of their economic potential, using data that can understand the current situation, understand where you can go, and then track progress relentlessly and be honest enough to say, hey, we're making some progress here or we're not.
Right.
So we need
right.
to course correct. A lot of this just comes down to leadership.
Right.
It's not a technocratic thing. It's really about having, you know, the honesty to say, at the end of the day, this is about inclusive, sustainable growth over decades. So if it's not going well, let's not hide the ball.
Yeah.
Let's just confront it and figure out, okay, who else is doing something we may be, you know, cities are like John Dillinger. They just steal from each other constantly, right? I mean, you know, and then take credit for it.
Sure.
It's the American way.
It is. Well, I've always said imitation is the sincerest form of flattery.
Absolutely.
So, you know, and if I see you doing something that really works, I mean, I might as well try it. So.
And it's a global, you know, there's quite a bit that the European cities are doing there. Yeah. The Asian cities, I mean, in many respects, they're further along. They more emphasize the public than we do in the United States. We're more of a private public enterprise in many ways.
Well, right? I mean, and I think even just you mentioning that, I think of we have a public library here that I think stands head and shoulders above most in this country. one of the things that they did, and I remember the executive director talking to me about it, was that he sent some of his people to other parts of the world,
right,
to witness what amazing libraries are doing, right? Because again, sometimes we think, oh, well, everything that we need is right here in our own backyard. It is, but you sometimes have to look outside of yourself to gain better understanding and to gain some new insight that can inform how you, what you are going to take back to your home base and develop. And that's what they did. I mean, and so just the whole concept of not just lending books, but creating a space for people to really enjoy it. And that's actually what we've experienced. It's one of the reasons, and I say it all the time, that my wife was committed to moving to Northwest Arkansas was because of how robust the Fayetteville Public Library is. And it sometimes it starts with something as little as that to create a movement.
Well, and these institutions tend to reinvent themselves for different periods. I mean, libraries are still fundamental.
Sure.
To cities and metropolitan areas.
Yep.
And really are a window to the world for a hell of a lot of kids. I mean, so particularly given the internet divide, the digital divide, I mean, it's so fundamental. So they're being reinvented. And it's not like, okay, put them on the dust heap of history. They're actually more critical now than they were before.
Yeah. So before we wrap up, I do want to ask you about, and I know you haven't had a chance to really fully embrace groundwork. You're still learning about it and gaining some insight. The concept, though, of creating more affordable housing for that missing middle housing that we keep talking about that just doesn't exist in this area, just like it doesn't exist in other parts of the country. How does a program like Groundwork and their mission to create more affordable housing fit into this whole framework of new localism?
Well, housing is a fascinating topic. Again, I was chief of staff at HUD under Henry Cisneros, and this is in the early to mid-90s. And at the time, the housing crisis was considered to be something that was really relegated to coastal cities like San Francisco, New York, and Boston, which really had restrictive zoning and had an enormous amount of demand. Today, what we're seeing is the housing crisis become almost a uniform phenomenon across the country, both for renters and for people trying to buy a home. The barriers to entry and the cost of housing is prohibitive.
Yeah.
Right. So, you know, 45% of low and moderate income renters pay more than 30% of their income for rent. And in many cases, they're paying more than 50% of their income for rent. I mean, this is insane.
It is.
Right.
It is.
You can't have a functioning, prosperous place without building a constant supply of housing across multiple parts of the income spectrum. So this is broken.
Yep.
The system is broken. Now, part of the reason it's broken is because no one's really in charge. It's completely federated. The federal government does a bunch of stuff. States do a bunch of stuff. Locals do a bunch of stuff. It's completely financialized, sometimes in positive ways, sometimes in not positive ways.
Right.
A lot of investors out there buying a lot of single family homes for rentals and gouging
private
the renters.
Equity.
Exactly.
Yeah.
A lot of that. And that started after the Great Recession. And a lot of the federal programs are circa 1986, which is when we developed the low-income housing tax credit. Well, since then, about 85 million more people live in this country, and we're operating off a tax program that was invented in the 1980s. So the U.S. needs to confront the housing challenge. I'm working with a group of mayors, Mayor of Atlanta, Andre Dickens, Mayor of Cleveland, Justin Bibb, Fifth Third Bank, which is based out of Cincinnati, and a growing network of practitioners to basically say, okay, who's doing the most innovative stuff around the country? What can spread and scale over the next several years? And if the federal government ever comes to, you know, some kind of realization of what its appropriate role should be, what does it do?
Yeah.
And as you would think from new localism, I flipped the pyramid, you know, because we tend to think about the federal government as the top of the pyramid.
Right.
I think it's actually at the bottom of the pyramid. And it's in the service of us.
Yeah.
But they need help right now.
Yeah.
They need to basically reverse engineer smart federal policy from what's going on locally. So I think you're in a great shape here, right? Because Northwest Arkansas is having housing issues, but they're not as crazy as they are in other parts of the country.
Yeah.
So they're manageable.
Yeah. Yeah.
You can get ahead of the curve. You're going to have growth. You're having growth,
mm-hmm.
right? You're in a real sweet spot. So if you're able to conquer this housing challenge, both by adapting innovative practices from other places and then creating your own innovations, you're going to be in pretty good shape. So you've got an opportunity, and Groundwork and their allies is exactly the kind of collaborative efforts that need to occur.
I mean, I think we're kind of like in the perfect storm here in Northwest Arkansas, because as I said before, we have the university arm, we've got the philanthropic arm, we've got the private sector, and we have our local communities. And I think we all agree that we have a problem that we have to solve. I did have a question for you, because you just brought it up, the inverted pyramid, and I like that. Would we also view the state government in that same way from that perspective?
Absolutely.
Because it seems like
absolutely.
What I heard you talk about in some of your other conversations and discussions is one of the things that has to be overcome are laws, old archaic laws that are on the books that need to be restructured for a new day and age. We're in the 21st century now, and we have to do things differently. And in order to do that, sometimes you have to break a few rules, if you like.
Well, at the end of the day, the federal government is a government,
right?
And states are governments. Yep. Cities and metropolitan areas are economies. They're quite different, you know? And so the whole country is basically a network of metropolitan economies, as are states. I mean, these borders, as you experience every day, okay, you go, you know, 30 minutes here to the west or 30 minutes, you know, north or to the, I mean, you're in a different state.
Sure.
So these borders are completely artificial. Economies are different because you're talking about talent pools, supply chains, industry relationships, investments. So I do think the federal government and the state governments, their raison d'etre is to be in the service of prosperous economies and inclusive economies that work for a broader set of the population. I'm not sure they view their role as that. It's like, hey, I'm in power now.
Right.
I'm
right.
At top of the heap.
Yeah.
Not really. You need everyone else to do their business if you're going to succeed, you know?
Yeah, no, and I love it. One of your quotes, and I think this is your quote, cities are the vanguard of problem solving in the modern world.
Absolutely.
I mean, it doesn't get more succinct than that.
No, I think federal government and state governments, they are major investors. They love press releases. They love announcement of the new programs and initiatives. But at the end of the day, this is the level at which stuff gets done.
Sure.
Right. As Cisneros used to say to me, like, a lot when we were in government, at the end of the day, the federal government doesn't build one house. It doesn't educate one child. It doesn't upgrade the skills of one worker. That's done through a distributed network. We should remember that every day we're doing our work here, because our job is to help them do their jobs better.
Yeah.
That was a mayor's way of thinking about the world, which is, I think, the right way of thinking about the world.
Yeah. And again, as we wind this up, and I want to ask you, and this is just something that occurred to me now, and I was just curious to know your thoughts. You've been in this a long time. You eat, sleep, and drink this. Where you hoped we would be by this day and age? I mean, you still have tread on the tire, as they say. You're still doing the work.
Yeah.
You're out there with your sleeves rolled up. Are we where you thought we would be, especially just 8 years ago when you wrote this book?
Yeah.
Or could we be further along?
Well, I do garner a lot of hope that after decades of worrying about deindustrialization and excessive globalization, the U.S. is beginning to reshore, and the U.S. is beginning to deal with the climate crisis. And once the U.S. gets into action,
I
mean, we're a phenomenon.
Yeah.
Right?
Because people forget that sometimes, though.
I mean, we're an organic, natural place, and the fact that power is so distributed is a good thing.
It is.
You're not waiting for the regs here.
Right.
You're not waiting for someone to tell you what to do.
Yeah.
You just go ahead and do it. You know, ask forgiveness, not permission. Sure. I mean, this is an incredible culture once it gets motivated. So in some respects, I feel like we're on the right path, but the success of partisan divisions is not helpful. We're better than that. I mean, I spent a lot of my time, you know, moving around the world, and always very happy to come home because of this sense of innate innovation we have.
Sure.
You know, whether it's technology or whether it's just problem solving in general, right? So we've got to get this division is not helpful to us.
No, we have to get past it. We have to get past it, because nothing gets done if we are divided.
Nothing gets done. And there's a lot of bad actors out there right now. I think in some ways, this period will be remembered, yes, for COVID, but it will be remembered, I think, more by the geopolitical tensions with Russia, with China, with Iran. You know, we're in a very dangerous world right now.
Yeah.
And the U.S., I think, is coming to grips with that.
Absolutely. Where can listeners learn more about your work and follow your insights?
They can subscribe to a free newsletter.
Sure.
At thenewlocalism.com.
Okay.
I'm on LinkedIn. There are days I'm on Twitter, though I'm not entirely sure I want to stay there. It's sort of like a dumpster fire, but
it's tough at times. I'll make sure that we put all of that in the show notes.
So fantastic.
Have a way to get to sign up for your newsletter and to connect with you on LinkedIn and to just follow you in general. And I'm also going to put a link to the book, The New Localism, which I highly recommend that everybody get a copy. It's really an amazing book. I actually think that every city council should have a book club, and this should be the first book that they read.
So well, if they have a book club, I'll come back.
Yeah, there you go. No, I love that. So, but no, Bruce, I really appreciate you taking the time to sit down and share with us. Any final thoughts that you'd like to share about the potential of new localism here in Northwest Arkansas, just to drive the point home?
Well, I think places this size actually do have the ability to come together and do grand things. I mean, I've done work in Chattanooga, which is a similar size.
Sure.
So you're different from a lot of places because you're really polycentric. You've got multiple cities, but you've got this great base. You're growing.
Yeah.
You're healthy. And you've got this flagship university, which could be part of solutions across multiple sectors and disciplines. So believing in yourself, this is like a classic American phenomenon. We're very good at that.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
Compared to the rest of the world. I mean, we're very good at taking almost like a positive attitude to the future and just realizing it. That's the story of Pittsburgh. That's the story of Indiana. That's the story of hundreds of places in this country.
Yeah.
That's what makes us exceptional.
Yeah, American exceptionalism. Yeah, so it does exist.
It does exist.
It does exist.
So we could dial down the bad stuff and the poisonous stuff and dial up the positive.
Right.
We are great. And I think I think this could be a remarkable run for our country.
Sure.
We're finally beginning to get some of the essentials right again.
Right.
In a difficult world. So this part of the world can be definitely a big piece of it.
Well, I hope everybody here in Northwest Arkansas is listening to what you just said. And I'd like to now just put it out there to welcome you back to come back on the podcast after a little bit of time has elapsed, just to kind of see what groundwork has been able to do under your auspices and guidance and, you know, and continuing to get the breadcrumbs that we find in this amazing book, The New Localism. So thank you so much for joining us on the podcast today.
Thanks for having me, Randy. Really appreciate it.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. Well, there you have it, folks. Another episode of the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. To learn more about us or to find out a little bit about what's happening here in Northwest Arkansas, visit iamnorthwestarkansas.com. You can subscribe to our newsletter. You can also subscribe to our podcast there. Remember, our podcast comes out every Monday, rain or shine. I'm your host, Randy Wilburn, and we'll see you back here next week for another new episode of the I Am Northwest Arkansas podcast. Peace.
We hope you enjoyed this episode of I Am Northwest Arkansas. Check us out each and every week, available anywhere that great podcasts can be found. For show notes or more information on becoming a guest, visit iamnorthwestarkansas.com. We'll see you next week on I Am Northwest Arkansas.
Attention Northwest Arkansas businesses and talent seekers. Introducing Onboard NWA.com, your hyperlocal job board crafted for our unique community. Struggling to find the perfect match for your job openings? Onboard NWA simplifies the hiring process, connecting you with the region's top talent through tailored talent matching solutions. Whether you're an employer seeking expertise or a professional looking for your next opportunity, Onboard NWA is here for you. Discover more at onboardnwa.com and let's build the future of Northwest Arkansas together.